I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Homelessness in Massachusetts at its highest point since the shelter system was created 30 years ago. We discuss a report just released from a group of nonprofits that offers recommendations to address the underlying causes and solutions to reduce family homelessness. Joining us in studio is Rick Presbury, CEO of the Housing Assistance Corporation and member of the Regional Housing Network of Massachusetts. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Maureen Fitzgerald, Executive Director of the Regional Housing Network of Massachusetts. Good morning, Maureen.
Good morning.
Maureen, tell us what the Regional Housing Network of Massachusetts does.
The Regional Network is a group of 10 regional nonprofit housing agencies that cover every city and town in Massachusetts. The group, as a network, we've been together for over 35 years. Each of the agencies provides a variety of different housing and services depending on what the regional need is. Between all of the agencies, we administer over 20,000 vouchers, so an awful lot of rental assistance. Some of the agencies also do housing development, certainly, as you're familiar with housing assistance here on the Cape, certainly does that. We also provide some homeless prevention services, shelter services, really depending, there's a slightly different profile in each of the areas depending on what the regional need is.
I think most of our listeners are familiar with Housing Assistance Corporation here at Cape Cod, but 40-year anniversary this year, right?
Yep. It's our 40th year.
40th year. And you've been there since the beginning.
That's correct.
So what's changed and what's stayed the same?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because you can take so many angles on this. Obviously, my personal story, you know, we started out with two staff people and now we're probably got 125. So that's changed. I also think that the Cape, of course, has changed and we've tried to change with it. What our goal from the beginning was is to provide services as they were needed in our communities on the Cape and Islands. And so we've added things, we've gotten rid of some things and try to do our best. I think that the social changes in our country and our state have made our job more difficult. At the beginning, I would say generally the issue was people who didn't earn enough money to pay the high cost of housing on Cape Cod, and we tried to bridge that gap one way or the other. Now, of course, there are many more social problems that are much more difficult to solve. And in the field of behavioral change, you know, how does one get someone else to change their behavior in order to make their lives work better? And we all know that we can only change our own behavior. We really have a hard time changing somebody else's. So we have a much more complicated job to do now. And I think the satisfaction comes from seeing those people who succeed.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was surprised to read that family homelessness is at its highest point in 30 years. Back in 2007, the Massachusetts Special Commission relative to ending homelessness set a goal to develop a comprehensive housing plan. So what happened?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, we back in the 80s, there was a major push to resolve homelessness in Massachusetts under the second two administrations of Governor Dukakis. And a lot of things were learned during that process. And we're going through the same sort of learning process now. What's changed in part is that the economic problems and social problems have become so much worse that it's a much more difficult problem. There's the percentage of people in Massachusetts that are paying even more than 50% of their income for the housing is much greater than it was 25 years ago. And what that means is that there are more people who aren't getting a good education, more people who have had issues with growing up in families that don't give them the tools they need. People who have more issues with relationships, so there aren't two wage earners in a family, more people that have problems with drugs and or alcohol, and so they just can't make it. And so you have a really growing number of people who aren't making it. And even those, look at the minimum wage debate now, people aren't making the same amount of money they made before. So we're talking about people who average $8,000 to $12,000 a year in income from one sort or another. And of course, we all know you can't make it on twice mm-hmm. that.
Right. Yeah.
And one of the things that we found was as we looked, you can't look at family homelessness in isolation, that family homelessness is really just a symptom of what's happening more broadly, which Rick mentioned. Over the last several years, in addition to the pressures of the recession and the economic changes, there have also been a decrease in the resources that are available to support people. So those two dynamics in particular have really contributed to it. So as much as the commission looked at homelessness and trying to focus on providing housing or other solutions, there's only that only helps so many people at a certain time. And when you've got those other external factors that are still contributing to keeping a line of people or a group of people right on the edge who are really at risk, your numbers aren't going to decrease.
I think everybody knows somebody who's right. I mean, there are so many people living paycheck to paycheck. And mm-hmm. here on the Cape and Islands, people have 2 and 3 jobs just to, you know, to make it to that paycheck to paycheck. So right now we have, what, about 4,000 families in shelters and motels?
Mm-hmm.
And haven't we started to move away from the motels? Are we still doing that?
Yeah, I don't know what today. Do you know what today's number is in motels? It's been about 2,000. You know, it goes up and down a little bit, but not down that much.
It's decreased since January. The state has definitely been looking at trying to find alternatives to try to find places that can be used to provide more shelter rather than having a family in a motel where they, you know, may just have a microwave where there's nowhere for the places. There's nowhere for kids to play. There's all sorts of issues, obviously, in living in a motel.
I mean, there's the constant debate over shelters or motels exists in part because the shelter network is an established network that costs quite a bit to operate because you have 24-hour staff and you have some level of services and so forth, so that it can be a growth experience for the families who are there. Whereas in motels, they're really overflow. And so when these shelters are all full, the state uses motels, which are less expensive than shelters. So what do you do? I mean, we consider ourselves a right to housing state so that families with children in particular, if they have nowhere to go, get to stay in a motel. So the state is trying to expand the shelter network a little bit, but there's the push and pull of that is that once you expand the shelter network, you have to sustain it. And the second thing is that a lot of advocate groups want to put the money into housing rather than into sheltering. And so can you just subtract from motel payments or shelter payments and add housing? Well, no, you still need some emergency response, and you have to get this fine balance. And there aren't the resources that are really available to experiment at the level you'd like to experiment over a period of time to see what would actually work. So you have to theorize.
Yeah. And I know you've got a lot of recommendations that we're going to get into, but I want to ask you a question about the shelter system as it is now. What are the rules? I mean, there are rules for different shelters. You know, we talk about the NOAA shelter, for example. If you're, you know, drunk or on drugs, you can't come in, right? But how long can the families stay in these motels or shelters? And the same thing with the single homeless people. What are the rules?
Well, first of all, I want to make a distinction between the NOAA shelter and family shelters. The conversation today only is about families and family shelters, and they are entirely different populations, and there are entirely different resources coming into play to deal with those. But families and family shelter, I think, can stay a long period of time. And typical stay average now is about 9 months. And the ideal length of stay when things were working well 25 years ago was more like 6 weeks to 3 months. So we have longer stays now because the problem has expanded so much. On a sort of a side note, one of the positions in the paper is that we ought to make the 9 month stay beneficial and to sort of ramp up the educational programs and so forth, the readiness programs for people. And that's not being done to the degree it needs to be. But the whole push in shelters is to get people into housing. And as you know, from the income figures that we have, people can't just jump into housing without supports. It won't work. So that you try to find the financial resources to bridge the gap between what the family has and what the housing costs, and to get them at the same time to know how to be good tenants so they don't get kicked out for one thing or the other, you know, after 6 months or a year.
So this 9 months, what happens in 9 months if you haven't found some housing?
Well, people are required to do certain things in shelter. And some people do get kicked out of shelter for what's called noncompliance, and they just they're just
own.
Out there in the breeze, you know, figuring out how to make their lives work. And it sounds cruel, but at some point, you have to depend on the resources of the family themselves to take responsibility for doing things that they have to do. Mm. And you know, it sounds It sounds kind of ridiculous to have to say it, except that some people are not capable of that. You know, there are things that go wrong in people's lives that really handicap them from being able to make good decisions and to make good efforts on their own behalf. And, I mean, we can talk about that a lot, but it's remarkable and really frustrating to staff because staff wants people to succeed, and they have to. That's how they get their job satisfaction. So there are some people that we work with for over years trying to get them to be able to do something. It's not because they're lazy. It's just a lack of a certain capability, and we all have, you know, deficits, and we know what they are, and we work around them. But imagine if those deficits just prevented you from going out and determinedly taking your life in your hands and making good decisions. If you can't do that, you're in big trouble.
But there's also a very large percentage of people for whom the issue is income, mm-hmm. and that with the income of the average income of the families that we saw in shelter was between $8,000 and $10,000 a year.
Which is shocking.
It is, and it's how do you survive on something like that? So I think that for many families, even if you are resilient and resourceful, the income is still going to be that tremendous stumbling block to being able to get out on your own.
Yeah. We have found that even today, when you take the housing insecurity off the table by either keeping people in the housing or getting them into decent housing with some kind of supports, that they are very likely to do pretty well. But the really getting from point A to point B, both for some families and with the resources that we do or don't have, sometimes is really difficult to do. And that's what's happening now with 4,000 people in shelters and motels.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons, too, that we really wanted we really recommend an emphasis on homelessness prevention.
Right.
If we can dedicate resources before people are at the point where they have gotten into shelter now, have lost their connections to the community support they had, the kids may be displaced from schools. I mean, it's much more difficult to get back on your feet after that than perhaps some short-time assistance before you're evicted or avoiding eviction or finding alternatives.
Rick, we've talked about this many times. Prevention programs are far more cost-effective.
They are. The reason is that when somebody is in housing and about to lose it, it's pretty easy to correct the problem, sometimes with relatively modest amounts of money. But the most important thing is you avoid the trauma, mm-hmm. the sort of post-traumatic stress syndrome that develops for families who lose their housing. And so when that happens, you've got a much bigger job picking up the pieces. So that we have always advocated here in the Cape, going way back, and you know, obviously I've been here a long time, of really emphasizing prevention. But to do that, you have to work with people with a little higher incomes, because usually when they're in housing and are going to lose it, you have to work with higher incomes. So when they lose their housing, they lose some income along with it. And it has been difficult as a public policy matter when you can't manage to solve the problem at a certain level. Taking more people under the umbrella of help is counterintuitive. You can't do that because then you have more people that have trouble. So what we had luck with years ago, 15 years ago or so, is that we got a line item in the state budget to help prevent homelessness that didn't have strict regulations as to who we could help. And so we'd be out there every day, you know, helping. We helped 700 or 800 people a year usually keep in their housing. And so that made a huge difference. But that's not the flexibility is not something that government funding can easily do usually, because we're so accountable to the taxpayer and so vulnerable to attack that everybody wants to keep everything carefully managed financially, which is a good thing, but it also prevents you from doing some things that need to be done.
But that's something that was distinctly different from the Cape in comparison to the rest of the state. And I think that's something that the rest of the member agencies, the rest of us who worked with the folks at HAC, learned from. Mm-hmm. So the work that was done with homelessness prevention at HAC on the Cape was a model for other things that took place in the state, even some state programs. And I think that the numbers, when you look at the number of families who are in hotels and who are homeless in shelter on the Cape, it's you can see the impact, the sort of long-lasting impact those homeless prevention programs have had.
Yeah, I think people would be surprised. You know, here you help a family, and what's the average, like $1,000, $2,000? Is it not a lot of money to help them stay in their home sometimes? And the success rate on that, it's not like they're coming back to you each month saying, I need another couple thousand dollars. This is usually a one-time thing, and it helps them stay in their home and get back on track.
Well, our historical experience was it started out at about $1,000 that would do the job, and it ended up after about 15 years being about $2,000 would do the job. And I don't know if that sounds like a lot of money to listeners, but it's not a lot compared to what we're spending for shelters and motels. But what would typically happen is that we would help somebody either with a one-time infusion to solve some problem, or we'd pay out the $1,000 or $2,000 a little bit at a time over a year. But we kept close track of who we were helping, and people sometimes would get help in a second year, but we would rarely would that happen, maybe 10% of the cases. And then we would never fund people on a repeated basis because we didn't have the ability to have people become dependent on this annually. Of course, some people wanted to get, you know, infusion of money every year, of course, and we couldn't let that happen because we knew the result would be everybody would be ready for January 1st to come and get their check. It worked very well, but we lost the line item, of course, so we don't have that anymore. But
we're talking about family homelessness. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are discussing family homelessness with Rick Presbury, CEO of the Housing Assistance Corporation, and Maureen Fitzgerald, Executive Director of the Regional Housing Network of Massachusetts. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, this paper report that you put together, it's got kind of a long name, Moving from Rhetoric to Results, Recommendations to Reduce Family Homelessness in Massachusetts. So you mentioned that there were about 10 agencies, did you say, that would,
yes.
Yeah, that put this together? So tell us about who's involved and what prompted this.
What prompted it was our having the same conversation over and over again and deciding, you know, when you were saying what's changed in 40 years and certainly in 15 or 20 years, we keep having this discussion about, well, obviously there's issues with poverty and that's what's driving this, and how do we get those bigger issues out there, and how do we take advantage of what we've learned over all this time with working with families, working with landlords, and put it into one package.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is important to understand is that the people who are directing these nonprofits almost to a person have done this kind of work as a career. And I don't think you work at a nonprofit for either job security or the retirement benefits or the money. You work there because you really care about outcomes. And so you get to a point where you have a huge amount of experience and a huge amount of knowledge, and yet you're not solving the problem that you're trying to solve. And so you sit back and say, okay, let's start with a clean sheet of paper and let's ignore all the realities of limited funding and stuff and figure out how we could solve this problem. And so there were about, I think, six of us with, you know, hundreds of years of cumulative experience that really sat down and worked on this paper to try to say this is the definitive answer to this problem. And, you know, it may or may not be. You know, obviously there are lots of progress hopefully is made that changes ideas. But I think anybody who's out there listening who's curious should get in touch with us about getting a copy of this 16-page paper. I mean, it's a little bit deep reading, but there may be some interesting things for other talk shows or, you know, newspapers.
I found it online.
You talk about
online? The report. Yeah, you can pull it, you know, PDF online. Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Tell me how you get it online, because I have no
idea. All I did was I put in the name of the report, and there it was. The link.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so.
But I mean, so there's an awful lot of ideas in it, and some of it, you know, the things that I threw in there was that there ought to be a curriculum in shelters. That if people go to Harvard for a freshman year, they're expected to learn something. And why, if you're at 9 months at a shelter, isn't it a requirement that you participate educationally in some way, in a standard way across the state that's measurable? Mm. I mean, I think it makes complete sense. It hasn't been done. People don't want to spend the money to do it. I understand that. But when the system is not working, you have to make changes. And that's one of many changes that we recommend. I think we've got 18
recommendations. Yeah. Maureen, these were groups from across the state, right?
Yes.
So every region's represented.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I would imagine, like you were talking about the success of the preventative programs that we used to have here on the Cape.
Mm-hmm.
So did everybody kind of have an area of something that was working that you could bring into this report? You know, did you learn something, like, are there other models from other, besides what we learned about the preventative programs?
Absolutely. I would say we took advantage of the collective experience across the state. And it was good to have the benefit of groups like HAC, our group out in the Berkshires, also another area where I think the scale enabled them to have they've got a great homelessness prevention infrastructure and program and resources there. Mm-hmm. But it was also useful to have the input of agencies like the Boston Agency, the Springfield Agency, where part of what you have to deal with is just the overwhelming volume of people who need assistance.
One of the things that seems to me is that getting housing, trying to, sign up to be on these lists, the Section 8 vouchers, we have 90,000 people on the waiting list. It seems like that whole process is so complicated. Just from my own personal experience, I have a daughter with developmental delays, and trying to figure out how to fill out the housing thing for her, I thought, she could never do this in a million years. Isn't there a way? That's one of the things you're saying here, is make the process a little more simple, right?
Absolutely. Right now, if someone is looking for any kind of assistance with housing, there are multiple applications, multiple agencies, multiple waiting lists. So the list that you mentioned is only one of them.
Right. And there are hundreds.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that is one of our recommendations, is there are many, many resources through the state. Why have all those separate doors to get in? Why not have one application where you can apply to all of them? And certainly there's, I think the state's been pretty receptive. Hopefully we'll get some traction on that.
What about the Section 8 vouchers? I mean, 90,000 people, some of these people have been on this list for over a decade. Has the number reduced? Are they not creating more? I mean, what's the situation there?
Well, Section 8 is a federal program funded through the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And so there's great pressure on that program to not keep expanding. It's not an entitlement program, unlike Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth. And so you have to get on a waiting list and hope you get help, and you have to meet certain criteria to get that help so that you have an expanding need in a program that's not expanding very quickly. And at one point in time, Section 8 certainly in this country was a very successful and pervasive program that was helping people. In some communities, it's gotten a bad name, but I think not deservedly so. It gets a bad name from the few people on the program that are abusing it or mm-hmm. getting into legal trouble or one thing or the other, and then you hear it and people start to talk about it. But our experience going back 35 years is that people have a lot of success once they get on Section 8. We survey the people that are on our Section 8 program, about 1,000 of them every 3 years. And we get back just amazingly positive results of what's happened to families. But that is a resource that's not really adequately available now because it's not expanding on the federal level. And that's understandable when you look at what's happening with the federal budget in so many ways. How do we keep meeting all the needs in this country that we have? And this is one that is not getting met and portends bad things for the future by not meeting it.
There used to be a steady increase every year of federal resources, federal rental assistance resources. At some point, those were then targeted. So, for example, the Section 8 vouchers that were administered through the regional agencies were all targeted to people who were homeless or at risk of homelessness. That was 10-15, that started late 80s, I think.
So if you're not homeless, then you don't get the Section 8 voucher? Is that?
Well, or if you were at risk of homelessness.
Risk, okay.
So that's a pretty broad category.
Yeah.
But what's happened is there haven't been new vouchers, federal vouchers, in years and years and years. And also recently with sequestration, there were cuts. So it's
and what you're saying is just exactly what I was going to read from the report.
Okay.
Is that
yeah.
so? Federal dollars are less. So what about on the state level? What's happening on the state level?
The state, in terms of in keeping with this rental assistance theme, in Massachusetts, we are very fortunate that we have a history of state investment in housing and affordable housing and permanent housing. And the state has a program called the Massachusetts Rental Voucher Program, or MRVP. At its peak, the state was spending $120 million a year on that program. That's also been cut over time. So now the spending level is $57 million. And so, you know, we've had these decreasing resources, we've had increasing pressure on the economy and on families. So that's part of the reason we are where we are now. To its credit, the state has increased the investment in permanent housing and rental assistance within the last year or so. So we're trying to get it restored, but we're still a long way from the support we had before.
Right. So let me make another point too. You know, the conversation makes it sound like it's all about subsidies to solve the problem.
You're reading my mind. Go ahead.
Good. the real problem, of course, is a combination of high housing costs and low wages. And so if you look at, for example, the lack of apartments being built on Cape Cod, well, it's no secret to why that's the case. It costs $150 a foot to build housing plus land cost. So if you're going to build a little single-family 1,000-square-foot house, quite a small house in today's world, it costs $150 to build the house. It probably costs $100,000 for the land, and with a little profit in there for the builder and so forth and so on, you're looking at a $300,000 house as the cheapest house you can really build now. And so people can buy that house, but they need quite a lot of income to buy that house, and so they don't have it. The second thing is, if you're building apartments, you've got the same equation, and people are going to be spending $1,200 a month in those apartments, and there's no profit in it when you build the apartments. So all the apartments being built now are subsidized in one way or the other. That's not right. It should be that people are earning enough, and it should be that housing is inexpensive enough so that the programs like ours are not needed. That's the ideal, and that's what we have to work towards, and that's what everybody, and people can be cynical and say, oh, no, we're just protecting our jobs. I don't think we have to worry about that, unfortunately. We'd all love it if we were worried about people not needing us. You know, we'd all be so happy.
It's radio, but I'm nodding. So
yes, you are. Yes.
And so we make our housing expensive by making additional safety requirements, by having higher expectations for luxuries because of wastewater issues and so forth. And that's all necessary. But how do we find the answer? So some groups across the country have built these tiny little houses. You know, I was talking to somebody yesterday. They're building these, 350-square-foot houses for people and so forth and so on. But they're doing it in a place in upstate New York that they can get away with it. We could never do that on Cape Cod. You could never get away with building, you know, lots of little units on a 10-acre piece of land and put septic systems in and so forth. You couldn't get away with it. I mean, I was jaw-dropping when I had lunch with this guy yesterday when I listened to what they could do, only 5 hours' drive from here. But you can't do it. And so what do we do? How do we make the compromise to create the product that we need for people? And that's a puzzle we have to solve, because it can't all be about subsidy.
Right. The other reason, when you asked why did we want to do this paper, is we did want to talk about the other things besides rental assistance that could solve this issue and that contribute to it. Mm-hmm. And certainly the fact that we don't have the minimum wage, as Rick mentioned before, it just, if you do the math, the numbers do not add up. There aren't employment and training options for families, for individuals to be able to raise their incomes to the level they need. The other point we wanted to make is it takes time. We've had some short-term programs where a family gets assistance for a very time-limited period, and the expectation is, okay, after 2 years, you're on your own. It takes time to get the education, to be able to get your child care supports in place, to establish transportation. There are a lot of pieces that go into this.
And just some interesting statistics on the demographics of the families that you serve that I pulled from this report. 81% to 94% of the families are headed by a single mother. The median age of the head of household ranges from 28 to 32. About 30% have less than a high school diploma or GED. And as we mentioned, our average income ranges from $8,000 to $12,000 a year. So it makes sense that this is a complex issue that has not a single answer to it. This has got to be, you know, a coordinated effort from a lot of different fronts, as you're mentioning, the education component, the poverty. There's a lot to this, which is why you have 18 recommendations.
Well, I just want to point out, the average age of a homeless person in Massachusetts is 8 years old. Yeah. And so there's the story, there's the future.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's easy to tell what's going to happen in the future. You know, the other point that was made in this paper, and it wasn't one that I made, but somebody else did, I thought it was very well said, is that those of us at this table are self-supporting. And we did this because of growing up in households that had expectations for us and made it relatively easy, I'm assuming, to get where we are today, including graduating from high school, 4 years of college, and maybe graduate school, all to get to the point where we could support ourselves. And so we expect people in 9 months to go from no high school education and no real background to help them understand what they need to do and to make that change virtually overnight. And it can't happen that way. It just doesn't happen. We have a lot of success stories, yes, but they're people who start out with exceptional potential in one way or the other, and people who can do things that I never could have done if I'd been in their situation. And they're amazing stories, and, we can tell them all day long, but the typical person is not one. You know, we all know the stories of some genius that grew up, homeless on the streets of somewhere or other and invented some great thing and made zillions of dollars, but that's not—
One person, yeah.
Yeah, that's not who we all are.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. More after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about family homelessness with Rick Presbrey, CEO of the Housing Assistance Corporation, and Maureen Fitzgerald, Executive Director of the Regional Housing Network of Massachusetts. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. I just want to read a section here from the report about housing stability, and I think people can relate to this. A child gets the flu, forcing a single mother to stay home for a week. Her part-time job does not provide sick time, and she's fired. A seasonal slowdown in business results in a cut in hours for a waitress, and she doesn't have the savings to pay the rent on a smaller paycheck. A family can't afford to pay for a tank of oil, and the alternative heating source, a space heater or wood stove, starts a fire that destroys the home. A mother is given the choice between asking her daughter and grandchildren to move out or losing her own subsidized apartment. A dad loses his job. When his car breaks down, he doesn't have the money to fix it and can't get to work without it. There are a million reasons that these families find themselves in a bad situation.
And we did all of those. We intervened in all of those kinds of situations when he had a prevention program, which was a non-traditional way of looking at it. And we always used to have these conversations about, can we actually do that with the money? No. But the whole object was to get the family firmly on their feet so they could use their own best resources to keep moving ahead. So,
we've been mentioning these prevention programs, successful, cost-effective, but the issue, now, I mean, there isn't enough money to help all the families that want it, but now we don't even have that anymore, do we? I mean, the money for that?
No, we raise the Dennis Yarmouth Ecumenical Council for the Homeless raises, $80,000 or $90,000 a year, and we raise other money for it, too. So we still have
some.
$100,000 plus to spend every year to do it. And some of the work that Cape Cod Times Needy Fund does, and there are other funds that do some of the same work. St. Vincent de Paul does great work. So there are other groups doing similar things that all add up to making the system, better than it might be.
And the state has invested in a program called Residential Assistance to Families in Transition, or RAFT. Mm-hmm. And that also provides that sort of short-term assistance to try to keep people from having to go to shelter or stabilizing their housing. There's also another resource that's used to help get people out, because sometimes even if someone finds an affordable apartment, they can't make that first and last month's rent. That's a huge challenge for folks. So there are some resources available for those. They're not as flexible as certainly as what's been done here on the Cape in the past.
And certainly the need is, we don't have enough in these preventative programs to meet the need, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Mary Lou is giving us a call from Chatham. Hi, Mary Lou.
Hello, I'm calling again because I get so wrapped up in your program. I was instrumental in Connecticut, and then as I moved to the Cape, I was instrumental in sitting with a group of people that did the Habitat for Humanity homes up here, and I guess it's like a whole row, and I go, wow. But, you know, I think about everybody, you know, there's a program going on right now. It's an award-winning documentary from Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson, and he talks about, this tells it all, church and state, love and marriage, faith and identity, and his struggle to distill the notion that God's love has limits. And you know what? We all live on this property that the Lord has endowed to us. What is happening? Mm. So thank you for bringing all this information forward.
Yeah. Mary Lou, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Martin, is the rentals, I mean, the rental situation, as we know here in the Cape, as Rick was explaining, there aren't a lot of apartment complexes. I mean, there aren't likely to be. What is the rental situation? Is there as much pressure on rentals overall in other parts of the state?
Absolutely. One of our members would make the point that even if we were able to, if everyone could afford an apartment, we just literally don't have the space for it, and we don't have available units. But in addition to that, there's the cost of rentals, and particularly in markets like the Greater Boston area, the vacancy rates are down, and rents are still continue to be high.
You know, it's amazing during this whole loss of housing value that people are so sensitive to in the Cape, where a typical house in the Cape lost 33% in value, rents didn't go down. Mm-hmm. They kept inching up. And I think rents stayed the same mm-hmm. for a little bit of time, but they kept going up. And, you know, how can that be? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But I think part of it is supply and demand, that there isn't really an adequate supply. And so, therefore, people end up having to pay more.
When you talk about rents, one of the things that we found was a study done in 2011 about how many renters do we have who are low income, who are at risk. And they looked at that by how many people are paying more than 50% of their income towards their rent. And the total number was 229,000 in Massachusetts. What struck me about that was the average income of that group per month was $1,300, and the average housing cost was $1,170. Mm. That leaves you with $130 a month for clothing, food, anything else. I mean, it's just staggering how many people are really hanging on by their fingernails and have been incredibly resourceful and resilient to make it. But I think that comparison of that income and rent number, how do you make that work?
Exactly.
Yeah. I think some people have what I would refer to as haphazard income, where they have a little something here and a little something there. And people do, you know, dog sitting, and they take occasional little construction jobs where they do repair jobs and things like that. And they have a little bit of extra money now and then. That's the only way they get by, because you can't get by on the types of money we're talking about. But then they don't have dependable income either. I mean, the rest of us, hopefully, you know, have a regular check coming in, and that's how we make it all work financially. Mm-hmm. But if you have not enough money and irregular income, it makes it that much worse.
Right. A couple of the other things that we haven't touched on that are on the recommendations. This is a big one, I think, especially on the Cape, is increase affordable access to public transportation. I imagine that's true in some other parts of the state as well. Access to public transportation is key.
Well, of course, you know, it's less true in urban areas. But, of course, what we've done on the Cape, and we're having the big sewer debate now, is that we didn't do sewers, and we didn't try to create housing development in village centers. What we did was wanted to spread it out all over the place in a suburban manner, so that there's no real way to provide comprehensive public transportation here, because everybody's living in a little neighborhood somewhere and they need a car to get to the grocery store or wherever they're going. And so we're now having the wastewater discussion anyway, but it's a little late. But the future development on the Cape has to be village center oriented, where people can live a more economical yet perfectly healthy life in village centers, as opposed to out on 2 acres of land somewhere and, you know, way off on Cape Cod somewhere.
Dana is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning. Thank you. I don't have all the answers, certainly, but I really feel, and I'm grateful for all these programs that are, you know, helpful to homeless people. However, I really feel the root causes of homelessness in one of the wealthiest countries in the world has been social forces larger than the individual, who are often stigmatized for being poor and homeless. They're lazy, they don't have a work ethic and all this other self-serving nonsense that corporate capitalists like to promote. I think it's been an upward distribution of wealth, as people like former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich have shown, and others, that have really, you know, the economy seems to be benefiting the 1%, if you will, and real at the expense of the rest of us. Yeah. I think we need less of a market economy and more of a communal kind of economy. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. I don't know the nuts and bolts of it, but I think we need to be more socially oriented and less market oriented in our economy.
Yeah. Dana, thanks for your thoughts.
Yeah.
And we certainly found when we looked at this that the poverty rates, the percentage of children in poverty has not changed dramatically for the better in the last 50 years. So I think that's consistent with what Dana was saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. David is calling from Falmouth. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Yep, go ahead, David.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for coming in and giving a informed and experience-based rendition of the problem that has been an issue for a while. I have Harvard-trained background in architecture and urban planning. I have 4 degrees. I lived in the Mad River Valley in 1983 to 1986, where Madeline Cunin's incentive to help end homelessness for lower-income or working-class housing was put into place using the statistics in our valley, was one of the corners of it, which was a faith-based initiative. We had 5 towns. 90% of the housing was unoccupied 80% of the time, and people were commuting from outside the valley at typically 4:30 or 5 in the morning to work in ski industry-related winter jobs. The fastest-growing single-family-owned home was a trailer, which was, by its nature, substandard and therefore was unindemnifiable, unless there were some unique and sometimes expensive indemnifying instruments. What was developed was a primarily faith-based initiative called the Bishops' Conference, and this was to recruit and persuade, for example, lending agencies, typically banks, that would provide mortgages that were federally indemnified, but...
Okay, I think we lost David, but are you familiar with that project he's talking about? No?
No.
Well, David, thanks for sharing. Sorry we got cut off there. But he brought up a thing, the faith-based community. There's a lot of great programs going on, even here on the Cape. You mentioned the Dennis Yarmouth Ecumenical Society and some of the things they do.
Yeah, the faith-based community is... by its very nature, the foundation of the kind of work that we do, that every individual is sacred and that we all have an obligation to be our brother and sister's keeper. So that is the starting point for a lot of what we're doing.
Mm. Joel called in and he wanted to share a thought. He said years ago, this land was a commonwealth, land that everyone could use to grow hay, pick berries, clams, etc. We've developed all the land and now we have to buy everything we need. He says he remembers Brewster when it was only 100 people. Thanks for that, Joel. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the other recommendations you have here is providing access to behavioral health services and case management. Case management can be just so critical in keeping someone housed.
Yeah, and that's been not historically a major part of providing affordable housing services, but it's becoming clearer and clearer that case management is absolutely essential. One of the things you have to do, for example, is to just, if you have 10 homeless families, you have to make a distinction between the one that needs the least ongoing support and the one that needs the most, and that takes an analysis, a case management plan to do that. It also occurs in terms of long-term sustainability. There may be 9 households that don't need much long-term sustainability support, and there may be one that needs a lot, and everything in between. It's become an important thing because it's such a soft service. It's so hard to measure things that don't happen. You know, if a family is about to, fall off the wagon, so to speak, and case management makes it not happen, you don't really know that as a statistic. So we're lobbying to have working to get more case management services to make the most out of each family's own individual potential.
And you had mentioned the challenge of filling out a housing application. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of systems that don't work very well together, that are equally complicated. The education system, if you're trying to get your kid into a school or trying to get special services for children that are special needs. So all of those systems are it's helpful to have people who can help you navigate through those.
Right. Who know it exists. I mean,
exactly.
There are a lot of times you don't even know what's out there.
Right.
Yeah. Steve is calling from Hyannis. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. I used to live next to a drug house. The person has died recently. My question is, why not drug test? I'm on Section 8. And, the fact is that the disabled people get mixed with all the drug dealers and the druggies, and most of us don't like it, but some people in the system are the drug abusers. And don't you think that's an abuse of taxpayer money to support that?
Steve, thanks for the question.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, it's drugs are a real problem. If people could easily free themselves of drugs, that they would, and that's a very difficult thing. We certainly try to weed out the people who aren't who are doing drugs from getting on the program or staying on the program. That effort, though, has to in part come from the top and the courts in terms of the ability to justify drug testing people. You know, you can't just drug test anyone you want anytime you want. Maybe we should all be drug tested when we get a driver's license. You know, I don't know. But who could disagree with you? Mm-hmm. Drugs and, that matter, alcohol are a scourge of our society. It's causing so many incredible problems, and we see it every day, all day long.
And this goes back to that providing access to behavioral health services.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Certainly there are some people who are going to need substance abuse services, and certainly here on the Cape and South Shore area, there have been plenty of news stories recently about the impact of addictions, mm-hmm. and it's a real factor.
Yeah, it's a huge one. Well, we have just about a minute and a half left, and I know we're not going to get to every point on this, but what else would you like to bring up then on your recommendations that we haven't covered? Like, let me look.
Yeah. I think that one of the things that I think from the grassroots point of view that's critical is intense coordination between state agencies. You know, that is that if some of the things we've been talking about, behavioral health, for example, we do have resources at the state level that don't always come to bear on the housing issues that we're talking about. So I guess what I'm talking about is greater coordination at all levels. And I certainly think in the future here on Cape Cod, HAC as an agency going into its next 40 years is going to have to work more closely with other organizations to combine services to make things work. Because, again, housing is not just a matter of providing enough money in the right place. It's a matter of all of the other things that we've talked about, jobs and mental health and education and so forth, that make things work. So that's going to be one of the future things we have to do. And we're talking about at our 40th Thursday night.
I would reiterate that need to look at things more broadly, that we can't just say, okay, how are we going to help these 4,000 families who are in shelter right now? There are system-wide issues that are broader than that.
Maureen Fitzgerald, Executive Director of the Regional Housing Network of Massachusetts. Rick Presbury, CEO of the Housing Assistance Corporation. Thank you both. And we'll put links to both your agencies up on our website, and people can download the report if they like to look at it. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thanks
My
for
pleasure.
The work that
Bye.
You do. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point. With assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.